Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the press conference following the first day's plenary session this morning. I have a number, not all, but a number of the plenary speakers from this morning who participated in a panel discussion on the current state of the epidemic worldwide. The first speaker will be Jeff. I'm just going to introduce all the speakers, and then each of them will give a very brief synopsis of their discussion presentation this morning, and then we will open it up for discussion. The three speakers that we have this morning are Jeffrey Garnett, Professor of Microparasite Epidemiology at Imperial College London and Chair of the UNAIDS Reference Group on Estimates, Models, and Projections. Ms. Elizabeth Fadul from the Dominican Network for Youth Rights and Global Youth Partners, HIV youth leader. And thirdly, Dr. Alex Coutinho, who's Executive Director of the Infectious Diseases Institute at Makerere University in Kampala, Uganda. So I'd like to turn to Jeff first.
Presentation, what I was trying to do was explore some of the different patterns of the HIV epidemic that we've seen across the world, in particular focusing on declines in prevalence in some of the generalized HIV epidemics, and whether those declines in prevalence can be attributed to the natural course of the HIV epidemic as it saturates in those with high risks, or whether we've seen volitional large-scale changes in behavior. And through using mathematical models to simulate the epidemic, we can distinguish between real declines in incidence and risk and just the natural course of the epidemic. And there are a number of examples now emerging of where we've seen successes at a national level. Ideally, we would want to analyze incidence, but the problem with measuring incidence is, one, we don't have a valid tool, and two, incidence is an order of magnitude lower than prevalence, so we would need to change our surveillance methods. I then went on to talk about combining interventions and how we shouldn't concentrate on one single change. There is a natural synergy by combining interventions that reduces the incidence of infections. And then to talk about the relationship between drivers, social, economic, structural variables that change people's risk behavior that leads to HIV incidence, and the methods we can use to look at those theoretical models to relate the drivers to HIV incidence. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. I'd like to turn now to Elizabeth Fadul.
Thanks, Craig. My presentation mainly focused on the state of the epidemic and the response in regards to young people. Today, the epidemic looks increasingly young, significantly female, and unjustly marginalized, with over 40% of all new infections of HIV among young people from 15 to 24 years. It clearly shows that the epidemic has shown a lack of involvement and lack of acknowledgement of our rights and realities in the national and international responses. My presentation focused on a call to action to leadership at all levels to recognize our rights and realities and move from responding to putting out fires to focus on a substantial long-term and short-term response that can adopt the following principles that assures that international dialogues become in-country actions and governments are held accountable for the investments made and commitments held. The implementation of evidence-based sexual and reproductive health education and information and services, services that don't discriminate us and that are safe and trustworthy. The prevention interventions focus on young people living with HIV and AIDS. That meaningful involvement of us and young people in greatest context of risk are prioritized and vital. That we celebrate our diversity of gender, culture, sexual orientation, and all programs and policies targeting us. That the provision of support and harm reduction services is prioritized, and that we complete the cycle of response by enforcing policies that address and mainstream our rights into poverty reduction, employment, and education. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I turn now to Alex Coutinho.
Thank you. My My talk was about the state of the epidemic and the response, with particular reference to the universal access targets. And as I said, my tagline was the promises of universal access, the progress to date, and the problems. I think the highlights of the progress is that 3x5 was at last met, 3 million people on antiretroviral therapy, the majority in Africa. There have also been significant gains in services for women and children. We have now 33% of HIV-positive women who are pregnant getting PMTCT services, up from a low of 10% in 2002. We also have 200,000 HIV-infected children on antiretroviral therapy. Some of the challenges, though, are that particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, there are many marginalized communities that are not getting services, particularly HIV prevention services. And those communities include men who have sex with men, injecting drug users, sex workers, migrant workers, and others. And unless we address these marginalized communities, we're never really going to be ahead of this epidemic. I think some of the comments I made is that very few of the countries are actually going to achieve the target of universal access by 2010, but that in itself should not discourage us. I think by setting targets, it makes us aspire to try to reach them, and when we do that, we generally perform better than if we had not set targets to reach. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. I'm going to open up for questions, but just before I do, just to remind you that headphones are available. We have English to Spanish and Spanish to English interpretation, so if you would like to ask a question in either English or Spanish, we all have headphones up here and they're available to you back there. If you could just state your name and media house before you ask your question. Yes. Please do. Apologies for the noise.
If it is working, yeah. Radio 1, Jan Huiblans. Question to Alex Coutinho. You mentioned the rise from 14 to 33% for mothers. This is a short intervention, I understand. Doesn't that lead to more AIDS orphans instead of helping... well, I mean, the question is, doesn't that lead to more AIDS orphans than when you would have mothers actually dying, which is, of course, a hell of a dilemma? You look as if you don't understand my question. Must be my stupidity.
I'm understanding it. I'm just trying to think of the implications of that question.
Right.
And I need to be sure that I've got you right. We had a situation, let me talk historically, we had a situation previously where prevention of mother-to-child transmission services were not there. And what often happened is that the mothers themselves died, but often the babies who were infected also died. If you have a service that is keeping the babies alive but is not keeping the mothers alive, then you might end up with a situation where you have more AIDS orphans. Prevention of mother-to-child transmission has four pillars to it, and one of those pillars is to keep the mother alive as well. I did point out, however, that at the present moment, only 12% of mothers who are HIV positive are also getting access to life-saving treatment, and that figure needs to go up. The aim of a good program is to keep the babies alive and keep alive and uninfected and keep the mothers alive.
I take a question at the back.
Trevor Cullen, Australian Journalism Review. A question for Geoffrey Garnett, or Garrett, sorry.
Garnett.
Garnett. Could you say now that the epidemic has peaked, or if not, when do you think it will?
So I think over time, the epidemic incidence rose, then declined, and it seems to be across the globe at a fairly stable level. Although in some places there are increases that's too big, in other cases that there have been declines. So I think you can say that so far we've had a peak in the HIV epidemic. It's very difficult to predict long term what might happen. So we're seeing really worrying trends in developing developed countries amongst MSM, where in the UK now we have more new cases of HIV infections in MSM than we used to have in the mid-1980s. So we are seeing new waves of the epidemic that may grow over a different timescale from the rapid early epidemic we've seen. So there's no room for complacency, but we did have seen in a lot of places a peak in prevalence followed by the mortality kicking in.
Can I just add to that question for you all? I think a lot of people are interpreting this notion of the epidemic peaking. People often think, oh, if it's peaked, it will then fall down. I wonder if you could comment on that misconception.
Yes, definitely. So what's happened is that at the moment, globally, the deaths are being balanced by new infections, and we're getting a fairly stable prevalence of HIV. And that means that there are over 2 million new HIV infections each year. So although prevalence has come down, we expect it to go to a new stable level with far too many new infections each year. And even in the places like Uganda and Zimbabwe, where we've seen dramatic changes in behavior and big reductions in prevalence, we still need much bigger changes to get all the way down to the sorts of incidences that would be acceptable.
And the other factor to add to that is that if an HIV prevalence peaks and stays at that peak over a period of 10 to 20 years, the population growth in our countries will mean that the actual numbers may double in 20 years, even though the epidemic appears to have peaked and stayed at a particular platform of, say, 7%.
Thanks, Alex. Another question. Here. Question in.
En la sesión, esta es una pregunta igual para el doctor Garnett. En la sesión plenaria, por lo menos así se tradujo, de acuerdo a estos pronósticos, que bueno, aumentará la prevalencia y podría llegar a una situación endémica donde cada caso causaría una nueva infección. Si esto es así, quisiera que abundara más a este respecto.
Okay, so I think there may have been a slight mistranslation. What I meant was that HIV prevalence increases, it peaks. If the newly sexually active individuals entering the population have a similar risk, you expect it to those that have died. You expect the epidemic to stabilize at a high prevalence. If there's reduced risk, you expect the prevalence to decline. It then goes to what we call an endemic steady state, a stable prevalence. And that stable prevalence is when each case of infection is causing one more new infection. So that's the situation I think we have in a lot of countries in sub-Saharan Africa at the moment, where we have one new infection over a 11-year period causing another new infection and the epidemic staying at a steady level. Have I explained that okay?
Alex?
I think if I add comments in terms of what happens at a practical level is that the risk you take in having one episode of unprotected sex varies tremendously in a population where the HIV prevalence is 1% compared to a population where the HIV prevalence is 23%. So if you live in Botswana or South Africa or Swaziland and you are having unprotected sex or you intend to have sex, you have to take far more precautions. There is less room for error, so to speak, because the background HIV prevalence is so much higher than in other countries where it's only 1%. Where it's 1%, you may or may not get infected, but you may get away with taking a lot of risks, whereas you may not get away with it in a country like Swaziland.
Fred Scheich, IFAR TV. This question is for Jeffrey. Since your information is based upon the EPI data, and it comes slowly, is there any efforts being made to increase the speed at which you can get that data so we can spot and respond to trends more quickly?
So over time, surveillance from the antenatal clinics and national surveys have increased in number and improved in quality. And hopefully the timeliness of that data is going to improve as well, although it does need analyzing and you need the governments to actually look at the data. So we're seeing an improvement in the timeliness of the data. We're also trying to develop methods that can detect a change faster. So we're only looking back 3 or 4 years instead of looking back 10 years. Ideally, I would like to be able to say incidence has increased or decreased over the last year. It's just we haven't got the tools to do that at the moment. I think in the US, they've been using tests for recent infection in a very controlled environment where they've calibrated the test for the United States of America. So maybe in the United States, they can actually look at current patterns of incidence. In the rest of the world, those laboratory-based tests haven't been adequately calibrated and validated, and so far when we've looked at them, have given spurious results.
Another question. Yes?
I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about...
could you just say your name and...
Oh, sure. Media. I'm Shannon Pettypeace. I'm a reporter at Bloomberg News.
Thanks.
And my question's about preventing mother-to-child transmission, and I'd be interested in hearing each one of your take on how good of a job we're doing, and if there's a few key things you think we could do to really make a significant impact that aren't being done now.
Okay. As I said, when you add up all the data globally, we've made tremendous improvement from where we were. PMTCT had a very low priority. We're now at 33%. However, that's the science that we are using in terms often of single dose nevirapine to both mother and child is not the best regimen for preventing mother-to-child. The best regimens are going to be more complicated and will require much better and functioning health systems. I always say that the litmus test of a functioning health system is how good your prevention of mother-to-child program is, because it is really one of those programs that does need a really good functioning health system. There are four pillars to a PMTCT program. The first pillar is to keep mothers HIV negative, because HIV negative mothers will get HIV negative babies. So the whole prevention interventions that keep mothers and fathers negative are very important. The second is to actually prevent the transmission of infection from the mother to the baby through antiretroviral therapy. The third is to then keep the baby negative through breastfeeding approaches, and the fourth is to keep the mother alive through care, because many of the mothers may have CD4 counts that are higher than 250, but also through antiretroviral therapy when that's needed. So you have to measure the whole spectrum of these interventions to see how effective you are. And as we heard from ex-president Festus Mogae, I think Botswana is an example of a country that has brought down transmission rates to about 4%. And most of the other countries are still in catch-up mode.
Just a follow-up question, please.
Go ahead.
You mentioned the 12% of the mothers that... You mentioned the 12% of the mothers. Were you talking about people that were above the 250 or under the 250? So are we talking patients, or are we talking...
No, I think I was talking about those who get care and treatment. Care and or treatment. 12% actually enter a care and treatment, not just treatment.
Okay.
Yeah, because they would need things like cotrimoxazole and other interventions. Yes.
Just a question from the chair. One of our other speakers this morning, Jaime Sepulveda from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, talked about the combined impact of combination approaches to prevention. Just as we use different drugs combined for treatment, he was discussing combined interventions for prevention, including behavioral interventions, biomedical interventions like circumcision, antiretrovirals themselves, and structural interventions, and the need to measure strategically the impact of combining all or some of those, or the negative impact. I wonder if any of you would like to comment on that.
So maybe I could try. In terms of the antiretroviral treatment that's being rolled out at the moment, there's no doubt if we can't prevent the new infections from happening, then we're going to have to keep increasing the number of people on treatment. The antiretroviral treatments themselves have a direct benefit, reducing viral loads and perhaps, probably, reducing transmission from those on treatment. But most of the transmission occurs in those people that don't know they're infected and well before treatment would be indicated clinically. So we need a big improvement of finding those individuals who are HIV infected and having prevention for positives. At the same time, there are more negatives in any one population than there are positives, and we need to change their behaviours as well. And it's only through combining our biomedical, our behavioural, our social, our structural, that I believe we can move to a position where the epidemic's under control. I think if we focus on just one aspect of HIV epidemic and believe there's a magic bullet, we're always going to fail. We do need to combine our prevention and our treatment approaches. One of the arguments of the need to scale up treatment is that it would facilitate prevention, and we mustn't ignore that facilitation of prevention.
And Elizabeth, just to follow up to that, as you mentioned, young people are disproportionately vulnerable, and particularly young people in marginalized communities, whether they're in concentrated epidemics, whether they're men who have sex with men or sex workers or drug users. What are your thoughts about this combined approach to prevention?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it depends on how we reflect how the information is getting and how we're drafting it. And are the prevention efforts that we are implementing, does it promote a behavior change among our targeted populations? And what strategies could we use to promote a behavior change? Because if we take, for example, the adequate information I have and put it against my risk perception, normally there's a big difference. So what are those prevention strategies that we need to do that make me have a higher risk perception of contracting HIV and AIDS? And that all depends on that. We can't simply say HIV is transmitted through heterosexual transmission, through its transmission also through blood transfusion, through injected drug use. We also have to adapt it to the population that we're saying it to. We can't just simply put the information out there and just put the statistic there. It's kind of like if we're doing a marketing campaign for a product, we adapt it to the public. We adapt it to who we want to change their perception. And I think that's one of the main things we have to do. And as Jeff said, it also has to combine with the treatment, the care, and has to be an integral approach that doesn't just focus on one component, but actually focus on all of the person and actually focuses on how that person can become empowered with the information of HIV and AIDS.
Thanks. Another question in the front.
My name is Agnes Asimwe. I work for the Independent magazine in Kampala, Uganda. There's a feeling that some people don't fear the virus anymore because of the ARVs. They are mistaking the ARVs to be a cure, and they're not scared. So there's a lot of complacency. What do you say about that?
I think a lot of people didn't fear the virus even before antiretroviral therapy. I think research clearly shows a disinhibition despite adequate knowledge. Translating knowledge into behavior has always been a challenge for social scientists. If we could get it right, we could really control this epidemic. I think the availability of antiretroviral therapy might have changed some perceptions about HIV not being a killer disease into a chronic manageable disease. We know this has happened in many countries around the world, and I think current efforts are to ensure that HIV-positive people speak out, particularly those on treatment, so that people know that on the one hand, yes, it is a chronic manageable condition, But if people had a choice of whether to be HIV positive or HIV negative, I would think most people would vote to be HIV negative. And so the media plays an important role in demystifying some of these perceptions among young people and not so young people about whether they can take more risks in an ART era.
Elizabeth, what do you think about what young people think about drugs, antiretroviral drugs, and whether that discourages them from worrying about AIDS or worrying about getting infected with HIV?
I think the fact that you have antiretroviral therapy, it means that for young people, that and mainly young people that are infected from an early age, that we can have a productive life that can insert into the labor force and economic force. And it doesn't mean that we have to lower our risk perception because of getting infected with HIV, because, well, antiretroviral therapy is applied to persons already living with HIV. And the fact, I think that it depends on how we put the information out there and how we actually implement our programs. And it's, for example, like if some people say that if you promote safe sex among young people, they'll have sex, and you should promote abstinence. It's the same thing. If you promote safe sex and give the adequate information, then you will actually have more of a risk perception and lower incidence rates.
Thanks. Question from the front.
Hello, I'm Phyllis Kachere, journalist from the Sunday Mail in Zimbabwe. My question is directed at Elizabeth Fadoo. Earlier on, you referred to HIV, the young people and the women increasingly becoming the new face of HIV. Maybe you could give me your thoughts on strategies, new strategies that could be employed to remove that. Thank you.
Okay, well, the first strategy is mainly participation of young women into the design of those programs. The second one is that we actually address the gender oppression and violence among women. And those social norms and cultural norms that are in our societies, we must implement, and I know the women activists all around the world have been doing a great job on this, but that we implement a behavior change among those authorities, among those government officials that actually implement those policies that discriminate us. And I think another key barrier, well, like I said, information is key, and we must have that available, and we must take a role, and we must lead the response to HIV and AIDS, and we must, yeah, exactly.
It sounds like you and AIDS and others talked recently about the notion of knowing your epidemic, that each epidemic is different in different countries, different cultures, and it sounds like you're saying that young people in a particular epidemic need to be part of deciding what interventions will work for them. Is that?
Yeah, definitely. How can you have an intervention that addresses me if you don't know my realities? For example, we have the statistics, we have the trends of the epidemic, but if we're talking about a response, how can you respond to my life, to my experiences, if you don't know what I'm thinking, if you don't know what is happening? And so, by the rate that we are involved, that we participate, and that we help in the development of strategies, these programs can actually have a real and impacting result on the diminishing of the prevalence of the epidemic of AIDS.
Thank you. I can take one more question here, please.
My name is Kakaire Shironda. I work with the Daily Monitor in Uganda. My question goes to Dr. Kotino. You say that most of the countries are not going to achieve the 2010 target. Is Uganda one of them? And if so, why do you think we are going to fail to achieve these targets?
Uganda is not going to reach 2010, universal access 2010. Universal access has many sub-targets on treatment, on prevention, and it won't reach most of them. Possibly it might reach treatment, depends on the scale-up. And there are several reasons around that. Some of them are leadership. I think for Uganda there has been, to some extent, around HIV prevention, we have allowed others to take the leadership that we once had in HIV prevention. because the newer leaders are promoting combination prevention, and we are not promoting it as much as we did in earlier days. There are also resource constraints, there are health system issues, so it's a whole complex set of reasons that varies from countries to countries, but Uganda will not reach universal access targets by 2010.
Well, on that gloomy note, I'd like to thank the presenters and thank all of you. Thank you.